today, who can lead Labour back into power? And ocean temperatures reach a record high. Heather, Parliament must feel completely different this month. I mean, we've got a massive majority government and Labour MPs turning up to vote after vote, knowing they're going to lose every one of them. What's the mood like?
Yeah, it feels very different, I think. And Labour MPs are still getting over that sense of the fact that there are lots of their colleagues, 60-odd colleagues and friends, who lost their jobs and aren't coming back. You know, so there's a very different feel to it. And there's a sort of new generation of Conservative MPs who are, you know, very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and busy taking little selfies of themselves as they go through the division lobbies.
Tonight, the division bells have just gone and we are on our way to Bill. What are we going to do?
We're going to get Brexit done. Yeah, this Brexit is our first stage and we're going to... It's really great that this is our first vote as well. Thank you.
It's a glum time for Labour MPs returning to Westminster alongside gleeful Tories. There's little chance now to influence Britain's exit from the EU, and all the radical policies they were touting at last month's election have turned to dust. But there's no time to wallow in self-pity. If the party wants any chance to mount a recovery and take on Boris Johnson, even in 2024, it needs to start looking like a government in waiting. But to do that, it needs a new leader. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, who can lead Labour back into power? I was chatting to one Labour MP who returned the other day and another politician who lost their seat for Labour. And when I said to them, what do you think happens next? I was surprised that without a moment's hesitation, they both suggested that Labour was going to lose the next election. I mean, describe the scale of the challenge facing the party.
It's a huge challenge.
Heather Stewart is The Guardian's political editor.
It was the worst result in terms of seats since 1935. And a lot of the seats that Labour traditionally felt it could rely on, you know, as I say, in the Midlands, in the North.
My opinion of Labour is they're not bothered about the North, Scotland, Midlands. All they bother about is what's going off in London.
Yeah.
Mr Corbyn, wrong policies. We don't want to be back in the 70s.
A lot of those fell to the Conservatives, who now do genuinely seem to be throwing quite a lot of effort into holding on to those voters, you know, into directing investment and so on towards those northern seats. And I think Labour MPs also look at Scotland, where, of course, they lost a lot of seats in the aftermath of the 2014 independence referendum. They said that they did very badly in 2015. And I think they kind of hope maybe that was a temporary blip. And actually, they now feel they're maybe looking at a kind of generational challenge in Scotland. And they're worried that some of these seats they've lost this time could take a very long time to win back. Although you should say that there is always a very sort of bleak feeling in the aftermath of a general election, and there's a tendency to kind of overread the, you know, the result that's just happened, and lots of things have changed and moved very quickly in politics in the last 3-5 years. So, you know, I don't think we should completely write it off in 5 years' time, but it's a mountain to climb.
Okay, so a really big challenge for whoever is the next Labour leader, but what they need to do to even get to the place where they can be in that position is quite different, because their constituents in this election are the Labour membership and their views are not necessarily the same as some of those voters that Labour lost.
It's grown quite considerably, the Labour membership under Jeremy Corbyn. That's one of his great strengths, was he was able to build this sort of stronger social movement, as he would say, and John McDonnell would like to see it. It's 500,000 odd members. And I think probably until very recently, we would have said they're very loyal to Jeremy Corbyn. They'd be quite likely to switch over to a left-wing candidate anointed by Jeremy Corbyn or by his team. You get some sense, I think, that in the aftermath of that general election defeat, there's a bit of fluidity in that group, I think. There's a feeling that, oh, well, actually, perhaps if someone like Keir Starmer, who doesn't have the great long history of being on the sort of very left of the party that Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott had, maybe if he can get us into power, well, you know, maybe that's worth thinking about. And also, I think the Brexit issue has cut across that bit of the left of the party. And so I don't think it's as clear as we might have thought it was a year ago or even 6 months ago that this group will sort of transfer en bloc to whoever Jeremy Corbyn chooses as his successor.
That's interesting. I mean, let's go through some of the candidates and start with the person who appears to be anointed by the leadership, although Jeremy Corbyn himself hasn't actually said a name. We think his chosen successor is Rebecca Long-Bailey.
I'm not anybody's continuity candidate. I'm proud of the fact that over the last 4 years, I've been immersed in developing many of the policies that went into our manifesto.
So she's a Salford MP. She came in the 2015 intake. She's a lawyer. She's talked about her father losing his job as a docker and the impact that that had on her as a child. So she comes from a working class background, she would say. She is hardworking. She's serious. I think there's been a real concerted effort to push her forward by those around Jeremy Corbyn. So, for example, she stood in for him at Prime Minister's Questions once or twice and was seen to have performed pretty well on that.
They have recklessly run the clock down on Brexit. But I say to the right honourable member, isn't it the truth that their failure is now running down the clock on our planet?
I don't think people would say she was as charismatic, or certainly not publicly as charismatic, as some of the other contenders. I think she thinks very carefully about what she says publicly and is quite careful and cautious.
And in thinking carefully what she said, she came out to give Jeremy Corbyn 10 out of 10.
Well, I'd give him 10 out of 10 because I respect him and I supported him all the way through.
Which is quite something after an election result that left the Labour Party with 163 fewer MPs than the Conservative Party. I mean, do you think she really thinks that, or do you think that she thinks she needs to say that to convince the members?
I think she's fiercely loyal to Jeremy Corbyn. And I think if you're someone who's in the shadow cabinet, who is sort of, as it were, signed off on that manifesto, it's quite hard to immediately distance yourself from Jeremy Corbyn, who you've so sort of staunchly supported all along. But you're right, it reads a bit oddly that in the wake of such a bad election defeat.
A bad defeat in an election that saw many of Labour's hundreds of thousands of members out on the streets, pounding doors and listening to voters. As you say, they're not going to vote as a bloc. There has been a YouGov poll of members in which Long Bailey did well. She came second.
Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer comes out on top, getting 31% of first preferences. Corbynite favourite and Shadow Business Secretary Rebecca Long Bailey comes out second on 20%, and the rest trail those two.
But she was quite far behind the other person you've mentioned, Keir Starmer. Tell me about him.
He's played quite a canny game, I think, Keir Starmer. So,
understatement.
He was quite a strong Remainer. He was absolutely instrumental in slowly pushing Labour's position towards supporting a second referendum, while simultaneously remaining absolutely loyal in public, never putting a foot wrong, so that he could never be reproached, really, by the leadership for, stepping out of line. He was very, very careful. And he was one of those who chose to go into the Corbyn shadow cabinet at a time when some others were still saying, nope, not interested. You know, this isn't the kind of leadership I want to be, or the kind of front bench team I want to be part of. He felt he could make more of an impact on the front bench than not. And, you know, he has been in a very central role through that sort of long period of parliamentary guerrilla warfare over Brexit. So he's been a real key player in this sort of drama that has dragged the Labour Party in this direction. I mean, his detractors would say that the decision to back a referendum was absolutely central to Labour's loss of this general election and really hammered them in all those Leave constituencies where they were incredibly vulnerable and which they have now lost. Starmer has an answer to that.
And my own experience was not so much people saying to me, I don't much like Labour's position, but they had bought the idea that if you voted Tory, you'd get Brexit done. And we didn't knock it down hard enough in the election.
There are those around Jeremy Corbyn who would say it's a bit ironic that someone that they see as an architect of the Labour's election defeat now is in this leading position. But of course, Labour's membership, not necessarily in the same place as the national electorate, Labour's membership are really quite Remainian, felt really galvanised around this particular issue.
next candidate in terms of that YouGov polling is Jess Phillips, and where Keir Starmer has played a canny and cautious game when it comes to Corbynites. She's someone who doesn't hold back, and I think she personally really regrets probably the language she used when she talked about the idea that she'd be willing to stab Jeremy Corbyn in the front rather than the back.
The day that it becomes that you are hurting us more than you are helping us, I won't knife you in the back, I'll knife you in the front.
I mean, she is loved by journalists because she's kind of charming and she makes great copy. But it's going to be much tougher for her with Labour members, isn't it?
She has been quite critical of him over quite a long period of time. And I think, you know, if you set quite a high store by loyalty to Jeremy Corbyn, you certainly would reject her. And there's also a sense, I think, I don't know how fair this is, but that she is more of a centrist, let's say, than some of the other candidates. She would say, great, I can reach out to ex-Tory voters, and that's what we need to do actually to get back into power. So, you know, it's no good just falling out amongst ourselves and talking about which particular wing of the party you come from. We need to reach out way beyond the party. And actually, one of the things she's doing is trying to get new members to join or to register as supporters.
People have got to feel a connection with us again. People have got to feel like we are on their side. And currently, I've heard it since the election, I've heard it before. They just didn't trust that we were going to deliver the things that we said.
She's kind of the wild card candidate, I suppose. You know, you don't know quite what she's going to say next. She's a campaigner. She's very forthright. She's got lots to say. She'll liven up the race if she does make it through to the ballot paper, I think. She gave a very memorable speech in the House of Commons where she said, you know, she'd barely seen an olive until she got to the House of Commons.
I have met many people since I was elected, none before. I thought I'd met posh people before I came here, but I'd actually just met people who eat olives.
I just think no one ate olives when we were younger.
No, they didn't know exactly. Yeah.
Who eats olives?
No, exactly.
Everyone eats them now.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Also on the ballot, Lisa Nandy, MP for Wigan. You know, once in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet.
Every conversation we've had today started with questions about leadership and questions about Brexit. But there's a cultural issue in the sense that people don't feel that Labour is for them.
Clearly has been thinking hard about structural problems faced by Labour.
Yeah, Lisa Nandy's been around a bit longer than some of the other candidates. She's been in Parliament since 2010. She's been sort of building support since then. I would say she's always been quite ambitious. She's talked a lot about trust and the problem the party has in winning back trust. She's also talked a lot about challenge
towns.
She loves a town.
Yeah. Many of the voters in towns like mine were told that they were stupid, that they were racist. And what they've told us in many towns across the country, including mine, is that we compounded that by doing what one of the people on your film was arguing for, which is investing in cities in the hope that the benefits would trickle out to surrounding towns.
Now, there are so she's talked a lot about sort of grassroots, bottom-up politics, ways of empowering people to change their lives and getting people involved in politics. So it's a sort of different approach.
And finally, I guess the opposite in terms of where she represents, Emily Thornberry, the MP for Islington South, who only just got on the shortlist in terms of nominations from MPs at the last minute. Why did she struggle to get support from her colleagues in Parliament?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because you would have thought that some of the points against her, you know, she's a North London, fairly liberal sort of lawyer who was very Remain-y, all of those things would count against Keir Starmer too. So, you know, maybe there's a bit of sexism there. Who knows? She hasn't been quite as scrupulously loyal, I would say, to Jeremy Corbyn's cause. She's a bit Marmite, I think. She's very robust.
You know, I've got a sister who's a bus driver. You know, I don't sneer at people. I mean, it's not fair to say it. I am a successful woman, but I have had a struggle getting here.
Good performer in the House of Commons. Good, she would say, at sort of taking down Boris Johnson. Good at sort of attack dog politics. But the flip side of that is that, you know, some people love her, some people not so much.
OK, so we've discussed the challenge that Labour's facing and the people who think they're up to it. They've all jumped the first hurdle, which was on Monday. They got enough nominations, 22 from MPs. What comes next in the race?
So they now either have to secure the support of 5% of constituency Labour Party. So that's 33 local parties would have to hold meetings and nominate the candidate. Or alternatively, three affiliated groups, two of which have to be trades unions. So they could be trades unions. Other affiliated groups include things like the Fabians, for example, which have to represent 5% of affiliated members. Now, in practice, that means you probably need one of the big unions on your side. So Unite or Usdaw or GMB, one of the big ones. So it's possible that we won't see all those candidates make it through, I think.
And what about what members have to do beyond that? I mean, in 2015, controversially, for those who became critical of Corbyn, they let people vote by just paying £3 to sign up. They changed that rule for the second leadership race. What are the rules this time round?
So this time round, there are 48 hours in which you can sign up to be a registered supporter, but it costs you £25. So we're in the middle of that 48-hour window. It closes at 5 p.m. today. It's one member, one vote, and it's a preferential voting system. So members will write on their ballot, 1, 2, 3, 4. They'll rank the candidates, or however many we end up with. And, you know, if one candidate gets 50% of the vote in the first round, they win. If not, the bottom candidate gets knocked out, and the second preferences of the people who voted for that candidate get reallocated. And you keep going until somebody's got 50% plus one.
So basically, if someone is everyone's second choice, they could win.
They could do well, yeah, exactly.
So you've told me who all the candidates are. We know that they've jumped the first hurdle and may or may not jump the second hurdle. Who's most prepared? Who's got the organisation and financial backing?
So two candidates, I would say. So Keir Starmer has clearly been preparing himself for this for a long time. He has quite a professional campaign team put together. He's got the support of Unison, one of the big unions already. So he's definitely ready and prepared. Rebecca Long-Bailey was a bit slower off the mark. So she didn't declare her candidacy until the last minute. She sort of wrote a piece in The Guardian over Christmas and then sort of disappeared really into the new year. And then she came out of the blocks with the piece in Tribune. And it seems to have taken her a while to get her team together, but she now does have a team around her. And she's very likely to get the backing of the Unite trade union, which is crucial. And also, she looks very likely to get the backing of Momentum, which is this, obviously the left-wing campaign group that was crucial in helping Jeremy Corbyn to keep his job in 2016. I mean, it's interesting, Momentum's stance, because they haven't had a ballot of their members. Their national coordinating group decided that it would ballot its members, but it would ballot its members on supporting Rebecca Long-Bailey for the leadership and Angie Rayner for the deputy. So it's a slightly odd decision rather than allowing them to choose whichever candidate they fancy. That, I think, will be quite important because you think about the links that Momentum has into Labour members. She will have a sort of ready-built campaign machine once the race really gets past this initial stage and up and running.
One thing I do want to talk about is gender. Labour has never had a female leader. I'm not saying that people should vote based on gender, but it does feel to me that perhaps women have additional hurdles that they have to jump over than men.
I certainly think when people are thinking to themselves, we need someone who can win, we need someone who can be prime minister, you know, and maybe when you think of prime ministers, successful Labour prime ministers, maybe, you know, sort of unconsciously almost, subconsciously almost, you know, what you've got in your mind is a picture of a sort of middle-aged white bloke. I mean, it's slightly depressing to think about it, but somebody described Keir Starmer to me as the sort of comfort blanket candidate, you know, sort of seems kind of reassuring.
You want to wrap him up?
you
want to cuddle up with him on a Saturday night?
I don't think that's what they had in mind, but he's sort of, you know, seems sort of competent, solid, reassuring, clever, you know, and maybe, you know, do people find some of those characteristics slightly more threatening in, say, Emily Thornberry than they do in Keir? I don't know. Maybe they do.
Our question here is who can lead Labour to power? And I guess it's who can lead them to power in 2024. And clearly, the only way anyone is getting the chance to do that is through the process that you've outlined, securing the backing of other MPs, winning the support of that key constituency of Labour members and getting the backing of trade unions. But let's just go back to that challenge that we began with. Where does the winner of this race even begin?
It's really hard, isn't it? And I don't think I've heard all of the candidates talk about the importance of having to appeal to those sort of lost voters in those seats that fell to the Conservatives. But I think there are those in Labour who worry now that it has a very solid electoral coalition in London and in a lot of the other big cities, which is maybe fairly middle class, it's quite liberal, it's perhaps it's Guardian readers, it's public sector workers, it's students, it's young people, you know, but how do you expand that and how do you connect together again, you know, with these other kinds of more traditionally working class areas where Labour perhaps felt it didn't have so much to say in 2019?
Right, because one of the challenges for Labour isn't just to win back the heartlands, it's going to be to also hold on to seats like Putney or Canterbury where they've got those Liberal voters. I mean, is there an opportunity there for them in that the Conservative Party have alienated some of those voters? And in 2019, they weren't willing to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, but they may be willing to vote for someone else.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the problem is there weren't really enough of those kinds of seats. And it's hard to see. I mean, there certainly are places that, you know, so down on the South Coast, for example, there certainly are places which would have been true blue and where Labour feels that it can make some inroads, partly because of sort of demographic changes, people moving out of London and, you know, places changing their sort of character. So I think they do think they can make advances, but I'm not sure they feel that there are the winnable seats in those areas which will make up for what they've lost, what they're left behind.
Boris Johnson seems extremely popular at the moment. He's clearly done very well in the general election. He's going to try very hard to hold on to those former Labour voters. That said, 5 years is a long time. A lot could happen. We don't know yet what the economic consequences of Brexit will be. Anyone who's hoping to be Labour leader will see a lot of opportunities in the next 5 years. But isn't one of the things that's going to be really difficult for them that they are entering a parliament as Labour leader that has a huge majority in favour of the Conservative government? And the big change that means is that opposition is much harder, winning votes is much harder, and having policy wins is much harder.
That's right. It's going to be very difficult to make an impact, to make a dent on this government, I think. And, you know, even in terms of public popularity, you know, Dominic Cummings was blogging away over Christmas or just before Christmas that, you know, they can do some really radical things and it won't matter if they're horribly unpopular for a couple of years because you've got a 5-year parliament ahead and they've got time. But I think the flip side of that is, you know, if you think about the two issues that have bogged Labour down over the past couple of years, well, one of them is Brexit, which has absolutely sort of driven a coach and horses through its electoral coalition, you know, hugely divided the parliamentary Labour Party. Well, you know, as Keir Starmer says, that's going to go. Those Remain Leave identities are going to be swept away at the end of January. And yes, there'll be a row about what our future relationship is with the EU, but it seems unlikely that it's going to be quite as kind of bitter and existential and that it's going to be a sort of internal, heart-rending row for Labour in the way that it has been continually over the past couple of years. And, you know, the other issue has been the questions, the wrangles over Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. You know, he was hugely loved and he was hugely loathed by different bits of the Labour Party. And, you know, the Parliamentary Labour Party, the MPs quite divided about him. You know, you had these coups, you had this sense around Jeremy Corbyn that he was under attack, under siege. And certainly it was an issue that voters brought up on the doorstep. His leadership, did he seem like a prime minister? Did he have this baggage of, you know, whatever it is on foreign policy? A new leader can make a fresh start. Even a new leader who is somewhat in the mould of Jeremy Corbyn can take a different approach, fresh start, make Labour look very, very different and quite quickly potentially make quite an impact, I think.
Heather, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Guardian political editor Heather Stewart. Do follow her reporting and that of her Westminster team at theguardian.com. Since we recorded this podcast, a new poll released on the Labour List website gave Rebecca Long-Bailey the lead in the race. So you can see it's going to be close. Do also listen to Heather's Politics Weekly podcast. Coming up, why ocean temperatures are the clearest measure of the climate crisis. Now, I'm sure we've all heard someone blame an unusually warm day on a heating planet. But according to Professor John Abraham, it is not the changing weather that gives us the true story of the climate emergency, but the changing temperature of the oceans. And here is a scary stat. The past 5 years,
are the hottest ever recorded.
Ocean warming is the critical way to know how fast the climate's changing. Since over 90% of the excess heat goes into the oceans, you've got to measure the oceans. In fact, what I like to say is global warming is really ocean warming. There are other measurements that people might be familiar with, for example, air and atmospheric temperatures, but those measurements are what are called noisy. They fluctuate a lot like the weather. And the warm or cold state of any day does not tell you whether global warming is happening or not, but the oceans do. Our measurements in the ocean tell us the oceans are absorbing an enormous amount of heat. And what we're seeing is every year, the previous year's record are being broken. The amount of heat going into the ocean is so great, it's hard to fathom. One way to think about it is it's the equivalent of 5 Hiroshima atomic bombs of heat put into the ocean every second, day and night, 365 days a year. So we're measuring an enormous amount of heat going into the ocean that has real consequences. As the ocean warms, it supercharges our weather. Scientists like to say it creates weather on steroids. The way it does this is warmer ocean waters evaporate water into the atmosphere more rapidly. That makes the air more humid, and it's humidity which drives storms. This means rainfalls can be heavier. It also means snowfalls can be heavier. It means that typhoons and hurricanes are more severe. So it really supercharges our weather. The second impact on humans is sea level rise. Warming ocean waters expand. And the only way they can expand is upwards, and that causes the ocean levels to rise. And we expect up to or approximately 1 meter sea level rise by the year 2100. And that may not sound like much, but it's enough to displace about 150 million people worldwide. Not only that, but rising sea levels make storm surges more damaging. But a warming ocean also affects animals. We've seen major, major die-offs around the world, and in particular near Australia, in coral reefs. There's no doubt about it. Our research presents some grim news. The oceans are warming, and if anything, the warming is getting worse. It's accelerating. But fortunately, there is something we can do about it. Humans can reduce the problem immediately, just using today's technology. The two most important things that we can do are to, first, use energy more wisely. Let's think about petroleum. Let's think about coal. They have an incredible amount of energy contained within the molecules. That energy can take a car and push it 60 miles an hour for 20 miles. It's really valuable stuff. We shouldn't be wasting it. We should use that kind of energy more wisely. If we do that, we will not only reduce emissions, but we'll save money. Secondly, we need to rapidly maximize our reliance on clean energy sources like wind and solar. And that's why I'm most excited, because wind and solar power has become so inexpensive that it can compete with coal and other fossil fuels today. And when people realize they can save money and save the climate at the same time, then real change is possible.
That was Professor John Abraham of the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Our environment editor, Damien Carrington, has written about this story. Do read it on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Heather Stewart and Professor John Abraham. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.